This is Ian Dale with my look back at the week whilst I've been standing in for Nick Ferrari at breakfast here on LBC. What's in a name, you might say, but I think in this case there is a lot in what we call the so-called Islamic State. Now, I have a policy on my Drive Time show in that I never call them Islamic State because it confers on them, I think, too much respectability. So I call them ISIS. But of course, if you think what ISIS stands for, it is actually sort of very much the same. But I think calling them an acronym is somehow right. Now, some people call them ISIL. Some people call them Daesh, which actually is a sort of slightly insulting word. So maybe we should all get used to calling them that. That's what they're called in France, for example. If you speak to any French radio or TV station, we'll call them Daesh rather than ISIS. Now, the reason this has become a bone of contention is because the BBC has been accused by government ministers of pandering to terrorists because they claim they have a duty to remain impartial to the so-called Islamic State. Lord Hall, the BBC Director General, he's rejected a call from more than 100 MPs for the corporation to stop using the name Islamic State on the grounds that it gives the impression of support for its opponents. Now, I have to say, I part company there. I don't think it gives an impression of support. Just because you call something Islamic State does not necessarily mean that you support them at all. But I have to say, I've been urging all my LBC colleagues not to use, and this is before this row broke up, to not to use the phrase Islamic State and to use ISIS. So I wonder what your view is. Does it really matter? Do you think less of the BBC for still insisting on calling them so-called Islamic State? I mean, they do actually use the prefix so-called. So I think it's a bit rich to have too much of a go at them, but a lot of MPs seem to disagree. 0345 6060 973. Michael Fallon, the Defence Secretary, he says the BBC needs to be impartial about the facts, but you can't be impartial between terrorism and the rules by which the rest of us live. Another Cabinet Minister told The Telegraph, the BBC has reached a new level of madness. This is utterly outrageous. Is it? Tim Luckhurst joins us, head of the Centre for Journalism at the University of Kent, former BBC executive. Tim, good morning.
Good morning, Ian.
Are these MPs going totally over the top here?
Yes, they are going completely and deliberately over the top in what is an entirely confected row, which should be seen entirely in the context of the argument over the BBC's charter renewal and its licence fee. The name that the BBC uses for ISIS, ISIL, Islamic State, or Daesh matters much less than the meaning it conveys. And the BBC's journalism has done a great deal to convey the powerful and important impression that this is a vicious, absolutist organisation wedded to an ideology which is completely and utterly hostile to everything that British democracy stands for. To suggest that the BBC has not conveyed the very clear impression of what this organisation stands for is simply to misrepresent reality.
Now, you've written about this in the past, but there have been other occasions when the BBC has come under fire for similar decisions. For example, in the Falklands War, when the BBC referred to British forces as the British forces, not our forces, and that there was, I think, a similar row about the IRA as well. So this is nothing new, is it?
It's not remotely new. The BBC has, as you accurately say, Ian, been attacked repeatedly over the Suez Crisis in 1956, over the Falklands in 1982-3. It's been attacked over its coverage of Northern Ireland. On each occasion, it has emerged with greater respect at home and around the world for its absolute fairness in seeking to report accurately and seeking to convey understanding. What's very interesting in this particular instance is that MPs are delighted to use the example of the Second World War. And I think what that says about their view of how the BBC should behave is actually quite troubling. Because, of course, in the Second World War, for very good reasons, in what was a unique war of national survival, the BBC did not have a free hand. It was essentially an agent of the Ministry of Information. It served to maintain morale at home. Foreign correspondents working abroad from 1944 onwards wore the uniform of the British Army. Now, I don't object to any of that. In the unique circumstances of the time, it was entirely appropriate. But this was a time when the BBC was broadcasting on behalf of the British government and the British people and the People's War. The circumstances which have arisen since, in all of their complexity, are not comparable with it. And it is interesting that the only comparison that MPs are interested in is World War II.
Tim, thank you very much indeed. That's Tim Luckhurst, head of the Centre for Journalism at the University of Kent, and he was a former BBC executive editor of various news programmes, so he knows what he's talking about. Let's go to your calls. In fact, before we do, let's have a text from John, who says, why not refer to the murdering scum simply as Islamic fascists? That's exactly what they are. Well, you're absolutely right in that, but I'm not sure that I'd want to spend all my time using that phrase, but there we go. Mary is in Croydon. Hello, Mary.
Hello. They shouldn't be called ISIS or whatever these people are called. They should be called IMS, which is irresponsible murdering scum, which is what they are. And it's time the moderates, Muslims, of which I have many friends, started getting together and doing something about these people.
Mary, you are right in how you describe them, but you can't really imagine a situation where Lisa Aziz starts her news bulletins by saying the irresponsible murdering scum have blown up people in Iraq today. I mean, you can't do that as a news organisation. You've got to have some way of describing them that is at least, I don't know about neutral, but it describes sort of I suppose just in terms that people can understand and describes what they are. And I suppose your phrase does that in a way, but it's just never going to happen on a news programme, is it?
Probably not. But if they say they have a God, Muhammad, as they say, whatever, isn't it time he spoke to these people and told them to stop this murdering that's going on? It's absolutely vile. And I'm scared. I'm scared for my grandchildren. I really am scared for my grandchildren.
Well, I think anybody who looks at what they've done, not just in Tunisia in the last week, but, I mean, the beheadings in particular. I mean, let's face it, we've had terrorist attacks throughout sort of history. Throughout the last 100 years, there have been all sorts of different terrorist attacks that occurred in a number of parts of the world. What ISIS have done, though, is taken it to a completely different level. They've gone back to the Middle Ages with the beheadings and sort of, like, dropping gay people off roofs, and then they're sort of kicked to death when they sort of land on the ground. I mean, that sort of thing just harks back to centuries ago, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And as I said, it's time their God, if they believe in a God, which they're supposed to, spoke to them and did something about it. I can't find words to describe how I feel. And by the way, while I'm on the subject, I wanted to make for a quick mention from Russell Brand. He should stay out of politics, away from politics, and just be a simple idiot that he is.
Well, I do have some sympathy with that. I don't. I don't think anybody should stay out of politics. I think it is a good thing that people like him can actually feel free to express themselves in politics. I've never actually heard him say anything I agree with, apart from I support West Ham United. So that's the only thing he's got going in his favour. Some people might disagree with that. James is in Sutton. Hello, James. James, what would you like to tell me? Turn your radio off, please. Oh, dear. I think we'll come back to James, shall we? That seems to be the best course of action there. Mo says, definitely call them Daesh. It's the perfect mix of satire and description for their intentions. We're asking you, what should we call ISIS? Islamic State, Daesh, fascist murdering scum? That seems to be quite a favourite among several of you. Lisa's in Maida Vale. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for taking my call. Well, I want to make an announcement of a Twitter storm campaign, which will start this afternoon after the 1 minute silence, so at 12 noon and 1 minute. And basically, we're using hashtag no to Daesh because we want to spread this message that no, we shouldn't be saying the Islamic State. We should be using Daesh because, we want this message to be spreading to all governments, all news outlets. I hope that everyone can join the Twitter campaign. It's been launched by human rights activists, journalists, lawyers. You know, it's a group of us
pardon me for sort of raining on your parade, Lisa, but what does it actually achieve? Because nobody in the civilised world agrees with Daesh. So just saying no to Daesh, I mean, apart from making us all feel better about ourselves, what does it actually achieve?
Well, in Arabic, when it's been used in the media in Arabic, Daesh, it's actually been seen as an insult to them. For not saying you know, the Islamic State, because that's the whole point of their, you know, barbaric, you know, invasion of the region. You know, they want to create an Islamic State. And by using Daesh, we're basically taking away this, you know, this from them. So if we start using it in English as well, we are, you know, we are bringing the same level of insultment to them, and basically we don't want them to hijack the peaceful religion of Islam. We want them to be recognized as a separate group, as a group of criminals, of a group of a gang that is basically just, it doesn't have any connection to, see, a peaceful religion.
A lot of people are now going to tweet me saying, why didn't you pick her up when she said peaceful religion of Islam? It's not a peaceful religion. There are all sorts of verses in the Quran which are very violent. Well, how do you respond to those people?
Well, if they start reading the Quran, I mean, I don't want to go into the whole religious debate, because it's not about religion. It's not. It's a whole political savage way of
But they say it is. That's the problem we have, in that they say they are doing it in the name of religion.
Well, that's why we should start using Daesh to not associate them with the religion of Islam, because it's not about Islam. They've been killing Muslims over the last
absolutely, you know? I mean, you see that, and that is the thing that a lot of people miss. Lisa, thank you very much indeed. Good luck with that campaign, hashtag no to Daesh. That's going to launch at 1 minute past 12 today. Mahmoud is in Finchley. Hello, Mahmoud.
Good morning, everybody. When you say Daesh in Arabic, Dawlat al-Islami Arabiya Sham. Sham, it is Syria, western Iraq, and part of Jordan. They used to call it Bilad al-Sham, it is the land of Sham. So the word they're using, Daesh, is same as you say Islamic government or state. It is not insulting. That's the way they have called themselves.
I'm Ian Dale, looking back at my week on Breakfast. More coming up in a moment. This is LBC. This is Ian Dale with my look back at the week whilst I've been standing in for Nick Ferrari at breakfast here on LBC.
Now, childhood obesity is something that is a topic of regular discussion on this radio station. 20% of children aged 4 and 5 in reception classes are classed as overweight. By the time they leave primary school at 11, the figure rises to around 33%. Now, I'm all in favour of promoting healthy lifestyles, promoting healthy food, 5-a-day pieces of fruit and all of that. I think that's entirely right, and a lot of parents need to be educated about that. However, when I see a story that teachers have won the right to inspect pupils' lunchboxes, I tend to recoil at that, because to me, that is the state interfering too much. In the end, parents have to decide how to feed their children. Now, if they decide wrongly, well, I'm afraid that is their decision, and there's a limited amount that I think the state should or could do about that. An education minister, Lord Nash, has actually said that schools have common law powers to search pupils with their consent for items. There's nothing to prevent schools from having a policy of inspecting lunchboxes for food items that are prohibited under their school food policies. Now, if you're a parent, I imagine you've probably just shouted at your radio at that, because how dare teachers think that they can decide what your children should have in their lunchboxes? Isn't it up to you if you put a Mars bar or something sweet in a child's lunchbox? Should a teacher have the right to say, no, I'm nabbing that, and then no doubt take it to the staff room and consume it themselves during the break? I cannot think of a more ridiculous policy. It makes me think, come back, Michael Gove, all is forgiven. Because I have to say, Michael Gove was in charge of the Department of Education, I don't think that this would be happening. Now, I don't know how much Nicky Morgan, the current Education Secretary, knows about this, but I think Ian Austin is right. He's a Labour member of the Commons Education Committee. He says, with Britain tumbling down the international league tables and with a generation entering the workforce with less literacy and numeracy than the generation retiring, you'd have thought that teachers might have better things to do than rummage through children's crisps and fruit. I would like to hear from teachers, because I suspect that many of you will agree with me that this is a ridiculous proposal which should be consigned to the dustbin of history. Or do you take the view that anything to get children eating more healthily would be a good thing. And if this is what it takes, so be it. 0345 6060 973. Carl is in Orpington. Hello, Carl.
Yeah, hi, morning. I actually disagree with you, actually.
Oh, my goodness. I thought it would take until at least 20 past nine before we got someone doing that.
Yeah, well, a lot of it is that we just don't have confidence in the teachers anymore. And
no, what we don't have is confidence in parents.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't object as a parent to allow teachers who have the responsibility of my children outside of the home to inspect, you know, things like this, because...
Well, hang on. You're the one that will have filled the lunchbox, so that's your decision as the parent.
Well, no, not really, because the impact on society is that if unhealthy children have greater demands on our medical system.
Oh, take them away from the parents, then, because obviously the parents aren't fit to bring up children because they don't know how to feed them.
Well, I think you're probably right. I think there's
a lot
of parents in the United Kingdom that don't know how to bring kids up.
Always been the case. I mean, we can't have the state inserting itself into every part of our lives.
Well, every other area that we have a statutory authority, you know, kind of where bodies are responsible for particular areas of our lives, we would allow them to inspect it, tax inspectors and various other things like that. So why on earth, one of the most important things, teaching and looking after our children's education, would we restrict the power of the teachers? It's only because we lack the confidence in teachers and they're not given the credibility that they should have because we don't respect education. And that's the problem.
I think you've got a bit of a point there. I don't think we give teachers a status in our society, but do we really want to reduce teachers to the status of food inspectors?
Yes, we do.
Oh, dear. Carl, I mean, I just can't believe that you're saying this. I'm going to go
to...
Stay on the line, Carl, because I'm going to speak to Michael, who may have a slightly different perspective on this, or maybe not. Michael, what would you like to say?
Hi there, good morning, Ian. Great show. You're stepping in for Nick really well, actually.
Well, thank you.
I've been a teacher for 25 years, and under the Healthy Schools mark, which has been around for many years, for schools to be able to get this, they have to have had a healthy packed lunch type policy, and anything unhealthy within the packed lunch, as long as it was agreed by the governors, then they could actually remove unhealthy food for the last 8 years, Ian.
And how often does that happen?
Actually, it happens quite often, but actually we are with parents, educating them, getting parents in over lunchtime, seeing what the school provides for them, and also we get people in after school to help the parents, as in what's good for the children, in the kind of like the slow releasing sugars, because sometimes you do see spikes in children when they've had a sugar rush. So we try and help them in relation to...
Well, I try and have a sugar rush about 6:59 before I start doing this programme. I find it helps. I'm a diabetic.
I have one every morning before I go to work. Great show, Ian.
All right, Michael, thank you. Well, Carl, he didn't disagree with you there. I thought he was going to, but...
No, I mean, I think he proved my point, really. I mean, and the other point I would add to that is that rules and laws are made out of necessity, not out of choice. The fact that there was a policy and rule in place meant that we'd lost our way. And principally, you know, we need to be brought back to...
Well, look, I'm all for trying to educate parents about healthy foods and all the rest of it. There's nothing wrong with that at all. But I think this has been dreamed up by civil servants in the Department of Education because that's what they're there to do, dream up ridiculous rules that will annoy people.
Traditional standards, to bring us back to a traditional form of the way that we should be rather than the way that we are.
Carl...
Our children are our future. We've got to invest in those.
There's a song there, so, isn't there? I can't remember what it is, but I think you're quoting from Nicole Ambition Frieden from Eurovision 1984 or something like that. What a geek. Liz Fraser joins us, author, broadcaster and parenting expert. Liz, very good morning.
Good morning.
Now, if you I don't know if you have children or not. I assume that you probably do as a parenting expert.
I have three of them.
Thought you might.
I do.
Now,
what I do.
if one of your children came home and said, "Mummy, this teacher has taken away my Mars bar. What are you going to do about it?" What would you say?
Well, I wouldn't be very pleased, to be honest, because of the way that it was done. And I think in all of this, we have to remember that, you know, the way to go about trying to make sure children, you know, eat well and are healthy and blah, 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 is not to go around at the moment, in the moment, in front of all of their friends and blah, 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 and take food away from them. It's a particularly bizarre way of doing it, and not something that I would support. I really agree with what Gentleman Raffour was saying, you know, and I mean, this is, unless that was you, I'm sorry, I've only literally just joined the programme, you know, about the, you know, this is just not the way to go about doing it, really, bringing in some sort of rule that teachers can rifle through children's lunchboxes and decide which foods they're going to take out. Which was what we need to do is educate their parents and make sure this stuff doesn't get there in the first place. And if it does, you go back to the parents. You don't humiliate the child.
No.
You know, they will be incredibly embarrassed, some of them. Some of them will be upset by it, depending on their age or their sensitivity. It's just not the way to go about it.
I mean, I remember having packed lunches at my school, and I think, if my memory serves me correctly, I would have a packet of salt and vinegar crisps, a sandwich, which would have probably been chicken or Spam or something like that, a drink, yeah, and maybe an orange club bar. Now, all of that nowadays would have been considered completely unhealthy, wouldn't it? Which probably explains why I'm now diabetic.
Exactly. And then actually, the main problem in children's lives is not the snack, you know, the little chocolatey bar that they've got in their lunchbox. That's not the problem. You know, the problem is that they're not eating anything decent at home. They're sitting around.
Oh, I did have an apple as well, I should say.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Well, you see an apple a day. Look at you. You're still going. That's good.
Just.
It's, you know, this is a pathetic little droplet in what is a massive, massive ocean of problem. And that problem stems from massive lack of exercise, you know, lack of getting up, moving around. They're in front of the TV, computer screens, phones all the time. So let's address that problem and stop taking away, you know, Mars bars from kids' lunchboxes in front of their mates and right in front of their faces.
Now, Liz, how are you on your Whitney Houston lyrics?
Ooh,
because, let me tell you, I believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. It was from The Greatest Love of All. I thought I would just educate people by saying that. I don't believe that teachers have any more right to do this than a parent. I mean, the parent is deciding what the children should eat. I mean, are we suggesting that we should have random inspections of children's lunches at home? Because that's the logical extent of this. If you can't trust parents to fill their children's lunchbox with healthy things, then you can't trust them to give them healthy meals at home. So therefore, you should inspect all the meals at home too, shouldn't you? No, of course you shouldn't. I mean, it'd be ridiculous. Jodie's in Hillingdon. Hello, Jodie.
Hiya.
Hello, what would you like to say?
Well, I just, you know, schools aren't, or governments aren't doing this for the sake of being awkward. They're doing this for the good of the children. I give my daughter a packed lunchbox every day, and, you know, well, schools have other policies that they have to adhere to. Yesterday it was 34 degrees, and all the schools had to wear shoes. They weren't allowed to wear sandals. You know, they have to wear these thick black shoes, and that's a policy that the school enforces. If there's a policy that the school's doing for the good of the children, then, you know, as parents, you have to adhere to those policies of the school. And if the school's got a policy for healthy eating, surely that's something that's actually quite fundamental to a child's well-being, as opposed to...
Well, and if they're providing school lunches, then they can do that within the school lunches. But, of course, not all schools do that, do they? So therefore, they have to leave it to the parents to feed their children.
Well, they do, but if that's the case, and if you think of a uniform, they have a policy of a uniform, and children have to be sent in with that uniform, you know? And so if they've got a policy for their packed lunch as well, then, you know, and there's lots of reasons why there's a policy for a school uniform, and they're quite good reasons, really. And the same for having a healthy packed lunchbox. And unfortunately, we're not the best educated country when it comes to food. And it does have a massive impact on children's learning, their concentration, their well-being. And I just think it's actually quite a good thing.
Well,
it's not something that's new either, actually, to be honest. Like, I can remember, you know, I was in school, like, quite a while ago, and we had healthy eating initiatives then as well.
Well, it's one-way traffic so far. Everyone is on your side, Jodie, on this that we've heard from so far. Let's see if that's going to change with Sally in Harrow. Hello, Sally.
Oh, hello. Excuse me. Hello, Ian.
Hello.
Over the last 10 years or so, I've worked in the catering department of three private schools. One of them was a boarding school for 700 boys. It's probably one of the top public schools. And the most notable thing, apart from obviously the quality of teaching, is what they have to eat. The quantity of the food compared to what my daughter and my grandchildren have was completely outstanding. They had three or four choices of very good kitchen in sight. There was no sweets that you could buy.
Mm.
And the most important thing you can do for a child, especially education-wise, if they're going into an exam, for example, if they have a very high sugar snack, like someone else said, or a fizzy drink, they get a sugar rush. But that sugar rush drops dramatically. So when they're doing their exams, if they have a very low sugar rush, it's going to affect their concentration, all sorts of things. And it's one of the most important things you can do for children is make sure they have a very healthy packed lunch. Or the quality of the lunch where my grandson goes is appalling. It's a private company, so there's a profit instinct.
This is Ian Dale. I've been in for Nick Ferrari at breakfast all this week, and we're taking a look back at some of the highlights. More to come after the news. This is LBC. This is Ian Dale with my look back at the week whilst I've been standing in for Nick Ferrari at breakfast here on LBC.
Now, a College of Policing review says the police service is resistant to change because of an insular attitude and chief constables who fail to listen to officers. Well, from fairly damning criticism there from the College of Policing, which you might be surprised at because it's sort of their own organisation, really, in a sense. I want to concentrate on one particular aspect of this report, which says that the police will need to recruit 17,000 black and ethnic minority officers over the next decade if the service is to accurately reflect the community it serves. Now, the need to make the force more representative, and all police forces buy into this, including the Met, this could see older white officers pension off early in order to make way for black recruits. Now, is that the way to go? Do you think it is vitally important that the police service does actually represent the ethnic background of the community that it serves? Is that important to you? Well, let's talk to John O'Connor, former Metropolitan Police Commander. John, very good morning.
Good morning, Ian.
What do you think of this suggestion?
Oh, well, it's a bit radical. Whereas I agree that the police service should represents the community that it pleases, it's not quite as simple as saying, oh, you need 17,000 more ethnic minorities, because what they need to be doing is starting campaigns of recruitment that make the police service look an attractive alternative to other jobs. And they haven't really been doing that. I mean, if you recall, back in the 80s, their buzzword for their recruitment campaign was, dull it isn't. Which immediately put into my, well, dull it must be. And it flopped, you know, spectacularly. What they should be doing is having campaigns within communities so that you can hope to start getting ethnic minority groups that feel some ownership of the police service. And from within, what they should be doing is reinforcing the old notion of what it used to be, which is an equal opportunities employer.
But you would have thought that these kind of recruitment campaigns would already be ongoing. It's not a surprise to anyone to know that there aren't a proportionate number of ethnic minorities in the police force. So I'm sure the Metropolitan Police is already doing this, aren't they?
Well, for 20 years, it must have failed them because they haven't got the feeling of ownership within the communities that they're trying to police. They haven't got the requisite number of young black officers. So, yeah, it must have failed spectacularly. And it's not just a question of getting recruits in at grassroots level. What you have to do, you have to widen the pool that you're trying to attract, but you have to do it from within as well. You have to have senior black officers who will speak out in communities and try and engender the idea of ownership, that they want to be in it. You can't just sort of keep offering the carrot and expecting people to come in and stay. What you don't want is short-term careers for people coming in, realising it's not for them and going. You want people who are going to stay the course.
Yeah.
And you want people who are going to convince the communities that they can make a difference. And that's the kind of campaign they should be offering.
I don't disagree with that, but inevitably, if they're not recruiting the requisite number of people from ethnic minority communities, there will be calls for positive discrimination. Now, I can understand those calls. I'm not sure I agree with them. In fact, I don't really agree with them. But there will be people who believe that that's the way forward.
Well, if they start on a course like that, they've got to look at the damage that's going to cause as well. You're going to raise expectations of people who may not have the ability to progress a long way in the police service, and you're going to disenchant a lot of good recruits from the existing pool of people who come into the police. They're going to be discriminated against because they're going to be saying, it's no longer equal opportunity. What do I do this job for? And I think for working class guys, coming into the police service and realising that it's equal opportunities is a tremendous incentive. And those are the sorts of things that they should be pushing. They should also be pushing the diverse nature of policing, the number of careers that there are in the police service. You know, the CID, there's a lot of travel abroad. It's a fantastic job, but they've got to sell it in the right way.
OK, John, thank you very much. I also really want to hear from people from an ethnic minority background. Why is it that you and your friends just wouldn't consider a career in the police? Do you not feel that the police service has changed over the years, or do you feel that you just wouldn't be made welcome? It's not the job for you. And if you have applied, give me a call as well, 0345 6060 973. Well, John mentioned equal opportunities there. Alison Malik is Director of Equality and Diversity UK, and she joins us now. Alison, very good morning to you.
Morning to you.
Now, why is it, do you think, that the police have such difficulty in recruiting enough black and minority ethnic officers?
I think the police are like any large organisation. I want to sort of quote the City Council in Manchester, for example, a huge organisation that built an infrastructure for bringing more black and minority ethnic communities into their workforce. They had an agenda from 2000 to 2010 called Agenda 2010, and it was a strategy to build this. It wasn't something that happened overnight. Now, if you look at the City Council now in Manchester, they have got those communities in place, in work. The Labour Force survey 4 or 5 years ago said that by 2020, 50% of the workforce will be black and minority ethnic communities. If you look at the 2011 census, it says that demographics are changing. So, you know, the business case for having diversity in all organisations, and specifically the police, is really, really important. The issue for me is that, you know, we talk about positive discrimination. Positive discrimination in the UK is illegal. Positive action is legal.
What's the difference?
The difference is that positive discrimination is you choose somebody for their race or their gender specifically. Positive action is where you target those people by running mentoring schemes, management schemes, getting people into, going out into Asian Mellors, Caribbean carnivals, recruiting people from there, as opposed to sitting in the ivory tower waiting for people to come to you.
But if I have two recruits and I've interviewed them and I think they're both equally qualified and one's black and one's white, yeah, and I decide that because I need to have a more diverse workforce, I decide in favour of the black candidate, is that positive discrimination or positive action?
Yeah, it's positive action. Now, what the Equality Act says, that you can select on that basis if both people are equally as qualified as each other. But again, going back to the City Council in Manchester, when they did recruitment and selection, they built this in. So they had ranking questions. So they'd have a ranking question, and equalities might have been one of them, management might have been another. And they tell you at the beginning of the interview that question 1 and 5 were ranking questions. So if we were equally scoring on that interview, they'd go back to the ranking questions and see which candidate answered that question more appropriately, and then make the decision. And that's about the fairness. So there needs to be an infrastructure, but there also needs to be some role models. We talked before about, you know, getting people in short term. And it sounds to me like you're saying black and minority ethnic people come, decide it's not for them, and they move on. Mm. But actually, you know, if you look in a room and you don't see anybody that looks like you, it's very difficult to go in. That's whether you're a male, female, somebody with a disability. But if you have more people who are like you, so working in partnership would be a classic example. Go and work with the City Council in Manchester. Find out the strategies that they had for their Agenda 2010 and build on that rather than having this reactive approach to recruitment and selection. You've got to be proactive. The equality laws in the UK talk about proactivity, and there needs to be some proactivity.
Okay.
in the police force.
Alison, thank you very much. That's Alison Mallock, Director of Equality and Diversity UK. Now, we are asking you, how important is it to you that you speak to an police officer of the same ethnic background to you? To me, it makes no difference whatsoever what the background of the police officer is. But I say that as a middle-class white male. It might be very different if you are not a middle-class white male. If so, give me a call, 0345 6060 973. Robert's in Southend. Hello, Robert.
Hello there. Good morning.
Hi.
I'm a serving police officer in the Met, and I am a middle-class white male. And I'm starting to feel very much so that I'm not wanted in this organisation, purely because of what we've been speaking about before. From what I would expect when an officer turns up to my door in time of crisis is that they have the skills and the knowledge to deal with any eventuality, not that they're there because of the colour of their skin.
Mm.
And I feel that, for example, there's many cases at the moment with recruitment where an officer has failed to pass the initial testing and has then been called back and said, oh, by the way, we've reduced the pass rate and, you know, welcome to the Met because of the colour of their skin. And I mean, obviously, I can't speak for ethnic minority, but I wouldn't like to be recruited because of that and knowing that I've only got in due to the colour of my skin. And I think positive discrimination, positive action is completely the same thing. To be able to say, actually, if you've got two candidates, like you mentioned before, with exactly the same skills, that you can then choose someone because of the colour of their skin and a quota, that's turning into the same sort of laws that you've got in South Africa at the moment. We shouldn't be doing that in modern-day Britain.
Do you not accept, though, that in the Metropolitan Police in particular, there is an issue? Because if in some areas of London, the ethnic minority population is well over 50% of the population, yes, and yet the police officers in that area, it might only be sort of 8 to 10%. Now, there is an issue there, surely.
Definitely. No, I absolutely agree. And I do fully agree with the fact that we need to represent the community. However, it's how we do it as well.
But why is it so difficult to recruit from different communities?
I think with I'm on the same lines as what your previous caller said with regards to the fact that if you do walk into a room and you are the only person of that skin colour there, you're going to be feeling very unlikely to want to join. And I think we have to try and, you know, be more positive in the way we do recruit, in the way that we put a light on the Met and the different career opportunities we have. The problem is, though, as you said, in certain areas where there is a lot of BME people that are in an area that is got a lot of crime as well, the last thing you want to do is join the police and stand out like a sore thumb. So I think we've got to try and figure out a way of how to reach those people that do want to join and show that actually it's not going to make them stand out like a sore thumb. It's not going to alienate them from their peer groups. That is the difficult thing. But giving extra tuition, extra opportunities because of the colour of your skin, I think is totally wrong.
Why? Just explain why you feel, though, that you aren't wanted.
Well, we had the commissioner on LBC after the first airing of the Met documentary that's on BBC, and on there he did, you know, say that he was looking at the way Northern Ireland deal with this situation, and that, you know, he feels that we should be paying off long-serving white officers to make way for new BME officers.
I'm Ian Dale, looking back at my week on Breakfast. More coming up in a moment. This is LBC. This is Ian Dale with my look back at the week whilst I've been standing in for Nick Ferrari at breakfast here on LBC. A Labour parliamentary candidate has sparked outrage, I tell you, by posing for a selfie at the exact spot where the Tunisian gunman massacred 38 holidaymakers, including up to 30 Britons, only 48 hours earlier. Now, Amran Hussein is an army reservist. He stood for the North East Hampshire seat in the recent election. He was pictured holding his selfie stick aloft as he stood in front of a pile of of flowers and tributes. Now, I have to say, I've looked at this photo. I think it's a slight fuss about nothing, but I suppose anybody who gets a selfie stick out in these circumstances is inevitably going to get some criticism. If you'd like to give me your views on this, if you've read the story, if you've seen the picture, 0345 6060 973. I wonder what the difference is between using a selfie stick and just getting someone else to take a picture of you by these floral tributes. Now, you might just think, well, you shouldn't be taking a picture anyway. Well, let's get the etiquette on this from Diana Mather, who's an etiquette expert. Diana, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, I have to say, I don't understand people who use selfie sticks anyway, but that's probably because I'm 52 and not 22. What's the etiquette here?
Well, I haven't actually seen the picture, but you're absolutely right. Really, it is very insensitive. I mean, by all means, if you want to take a picture and to say that I was there at that time, fair enough, but don't post it. Who actually wants to know? You know, everybody thinks I must post my picture on the internet so the whole world can see everything I'm doing every minute of the day. Why and who actually looks at it? Well, somebody obviously looks at it. But as a Labour councillor, any sort of councillor, anyone in the public eye, he should have had more sense to know that he was going to upset quite a
lot. All right, let me take issue with you. Let me take issue with you. In a week's time, we have the anniversary of the 7/7 bombings. If I go to the 7/7 memorial in Hyde Park and someone takes a picture of me or I take a selfie at that memorial, am I being insensitive? I don't think I am.
Because time has passed. If you did it at that memorial a year later in Tunisia, it would be very different. But the wounds, the wounds are raw. You've got to give people time and the relatives to get over, and well, they never will, but to get more used to what has happened, not 48 hours later.
But, I mean, it may be, and I don't know the exact circumstances of this, but say he was 100 miles away at the time and he's travelled 100 miles to pay his own respects to the people that died and takes a picture. I mean, I don't see a particular problem with that.
But why does he have to post this on the internet? If he pays his own respects, great.
No. Well, the problem is that somebody has taken a picture of him doing the selfie. That's the picture that's gone round the world. It's slightly different.
Well, yes, it is. And this is where, when we teach our courses on the English manner, we are really, really keen on making people aware what can happen, especially people in the public eye. You look at even David Cameron when he took that selfie with the Danish Prime Minister, and I think it was Obama, wasn't it? You know, once you are in the public eye, especially today when communication is instantaneous, you have to be aware of what your actions, how they can affect other people. It wouldn't matter probably for you or I, but the fact that, it would matter for you.
I wasn't going to say that.
But it wouldn't matter to some people because it would never get, viral and therefore the media picking it up. But as a councillor, he must be aware of his constituents. And if one of those people is upset, then you don't do it. It's not, you don't have to do it, you know. It's something that, you just got to be aware.
Well, let's see what our listeners think about this. Diana, thank you very much. That's Diana Mather, an etiquette expert, which I am clearly not. Let's go to Bob in Hanwell. Hello, Bob.
Hi. How are you doing? All right.
Fine. What would you like to say?
I think thank God the man didn't get elected. I mean, what kind of person does that? I mean, who wants to take a photograph of a scene of carnage where people, innocent people, have lost their lives?
Well, maybe the same kind of person who slows down and rubbernecks a road traffic accident.
Oh, come on, this is sick. It's like, you know, maybe it's my generation, but in my generation, we would look at this and say, this guy is sick. You don't do things like that. Half of these people
I don't think he's sick. I think the reason that there's this controversy is because somebody, maybe it was a press photographer, took a picture of him doing the selfie with his selfie stick, and of course, I think that's at the root of this, not the fact that he took the selfie in the first place.
So you would go down there and take a selfie, would you?
Well, I don't think I would. No, but I'm not willing to sort of condemn this man to sort of ignominy because he has.
Well, I'm afraid I am, because I think anybody that runs for public office should have a bit more intelligence and think that people have got feelings. I read this morning of families. They can't find or they can't identify the bodies. So they don't know if their member of family is dead or not. And this guy's going down photographing it.
Let me tell you, actually, what he said in his defence. He says, selfies are not banned. I don't see anything wrong with it. We were not capturing a happy moment. We were very distressed after what happened, and we went down to the beach for 30 minutes to show solidarity. We laid flowers and wrote a tribute and prayed to those who lost their lives in the horrific massacre. We would have asked someone else to take a picture of us, but we were in the moment and we wanted to take a picture with the tribute and flowers we'd put down. It's been taken completely out of context. It was all very upsetting. We just wanted to have a reminder of what happened. I just happened to be using a selfie stick, as that's what I always use. Does that have any impact on your views, Bob?
No, it doesn't.
Thought it wouldn't.
Actions speak louder than words, don't they?
Okay, Bob, let's go to James, who's at Bank. Hello, James.
Yeah,
You sound as if you're lost for words, James.
No, I was going to say, initially was going to say that I thought it was distasteful. As one of your callers said, if you want to show that you were there paying respects, take a photograph from your perspective, but not with a selfie stick. But just listening to what the man's response was, it's sort of fair enough. I mean, Twitter's a horrible beast for jumping to the extremes.
Well, I wonder if maybe I'm being unfair here, but I wonder if the Daily Mail would have been so anxious about this had they not had a ready-made picture of him with Ed Miliband to accompany the story. Maybe I'm just being overly cynical there. James, thank you. Alan is in Camden. Hello, Alan.
Hi. Good morning. What I would like to say, I mean, this gentleman, the MP, went to the reef where this accident happened 2-3 days ago. We have to respect him very much because he was very brave. He travelled to the beach and then to the place where this thing happened, and he showed the solidarity. And on the top of that, he shows to the terrorism that we don't get defeated by this. We have to respect him. And the second thing is, I was trying to write. I mean, it's the media who is trying to sell the story, any story, make a big fuss about it and sell it to us. And this selfie, what are they going to do tomorrow? Are they going to ban all the selfies from the market?
I tend to agree with you on this. I don't think it is sort of the massive story that the Mail seem to think it is. But I understand why people have taken against the man for doing it, but I don't necessarily agree with them. Thank you very much, Alan. Keep your calls coming on this, and indeed the police. Somebody says on a text, why don't people put their names on text? So it was put anonymously. What nonsense. Hundreds of holiday makers are doing this. They started only hours after the area was declared safe. These pictures have been posted on the net. What's the difference? Indeed, what is the difference between someone doing this and a national newspaper sending a photographer out there? I'm not quite sure. Jim says, why would anyone, let alone a government representative — well, he's not a government representative, he's not even now a political party representative — why would anyone take a selfie stick on a trip where 38 people had just been slaughtered? The clue is in the name selfie. No one in this man's mind but himself. And a tweet asking if Imran Hussein is insensitive taking a selfie at the Tunisian terror scene. He's a Labour supporter. What do you expect? That's really, I think, beneath you, to be honest. May is in Gerrard's Cross. Hello, May.
Hi. I just wanted to add that I'm not sure why they are not applying, but I just wanted to say, as someone from ethnic background myself, I'm Asian. It doesn't matter to me at all what skin color the police woman or man has. The only thing I expect from our police is to not be prejudiced against, to show the same courtesy the other way around. I've obviously never been in police trouble, but
obviously,
I was stopped once.
Unlike me.
But what I'm trying to say is that I was stopped once for not having my lights on when I was learning to drive. And, you know, I was respectful to the policeman, and he was respectful towards me, which was fine. They told me what to do, and it was fine. But I'm sure there are people who, who feel that they are targeted because of the color of their skin, and that might be the reason why perhaps the Met Police needs police from other ethnic backgrounds.
Because you see, one of the things which I thought was very odd here is that Sir Bernard Hogan Howe, when he was on LBC last week, was talking about how important it was to recruit more black and minority ethnic officers. And yet at the same time, he said there needed to be more stop and search because that was the only way to solve gun and knife crime. And we all know, I mean, I know from the phone-ins I've done on this radio station over the last 5 years, you just have to mention that word and the lines go berserk with people who have been at the sharp end of stop and search and feel that they've been treated badly, that they've been discriminated against purely because they happen to be non-white and maybe driving a car which a police officer thinks is somehow too good for them. And it's that sort of thing, I think, puts people off even thinking of joining the police.
I wouldn't take offence to that. I mean, personally, at the airport, for instance, I was a couple of times called aside the search for a bag. I didn't take offence to that. You know, fine, go ahead.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Maybe it's the manner. Maybe some people were treated. Maybe that's what makes them upset. But if I was to be stopped in London and to do carriers, I would just think the police is doing their job.
This is Ian Dale. I've been in for Nick Ferrari at breakfast all this week, and we're taking a look back at some of the highlights. More to come after the news. This is LBC. This is Ian Dale with my look back at the week whilst I've been standing in for Nick Ferrari at breakfast here on LBC. The Howard Davis Commission has reported Heathrow is to get a new runway, assuming, of course, the government agrees. Well, let's talk to the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson. Good morning.
Good morning, Ian.
Now, what's your initial reaction to this report? I imagine you're not particularly surprised.
No, I'm not really very surprised at all. I haven't had a chance to read it all in detail. I think there's some interesting things in the report, and you know, I'm glad, actually, he says some positive things to say about the estuary. I don't think that this is going to startle anybody. Sir Howard's mission for a long time has been to try to provide a decent cover for, you know, a kind of establishment U-turn on Heathrow Third Runway. I think what's fascinating is the restrictions that he tries to place on that expansion in order to get it through, you know, ban on night flights, all sorts of other new restrictions. And it was quite telling, actually. I don't know if you were listening to Heathrow Airport themselves this morning. They're very nervous of accepting these constraints. Because, of course, they won't ultimately, and they'll try to, even if this runway were to be pushed through, which it wouldn't.
I've just been talking to the chief executive of Heathrow. He sounded anything but nervous. He sounded completely buoyant, as if it was job done. Let's get the diggers in.
Did you ask him about night flights?
I did.
And did he say he would accept the ban on night flights?
At least I think I did. I asked him about the environmental
Did you ask him about whether he'd accept a ban on night flights?
No, I didn't ask him that directly. However, he said that this is a very different situation to 2010.
That would be a very interesting question to ask because they may now in the short term pretend that they accept these restrictions. So what they weren't this morning, but the reality is that they would be chipped away. They would want to go forward with inevitably a fourth runway in addition to this third runway, and that would be truly catastrophic. So I think we're a long day's march away from agreement on this, Ian, and other options remain very, very much in play. Don't forget, Heathrow already provides about a third of the noise pollution suffered by all the people around all the airports in Europe. No one else would be expanding an airport right in the middle of the western suburbs of the city in the way that is being proposed. And there are much better proposals. Britain deserves better than this environmentally damaging short-termist solution.
Are you going to carry out your threat to lay down in front of the diggers once construction starts?
Well, I'm not, because in the sense that I don't think it will happen. I think my services as a bulldozer blocker are unlikely to be required in my lifetime.
No, but if it did happen.
Well, obviously, of course. You know, I've said what I've said, but I think there are, as you said just now, I think there's a way to go before the government makes up its mind on this, and we'll have to see where we go.
Earlier, I was speaking to Zach Goldsmith, who accused Sir Howard Davis of already deciding the outcome of his report before he started. Just listen to this clip.
Well, I think, look, everyone has a prejudice. People start, you know, I wouldn't pretend that at the beginning of this process I was objective either. Every person listening to this programme will have various starting points, and Howard Davis is no different. But I do know that there are some really important things that he didn't look at.
This was Sir Howard's response.
That is an absolutely extraordinary thing to say. I do not know that Zach Goldsmith has any privileged access to my thought processes. I did not make up my mind beforehand. If he says I did, he is, I'm afraid, lying. And that's a very unattractive thing for a public figure to do.
That's a very strong response there from Sir Howard. Do you think he made up his mind beforehand?
Well, I don't think it's necessary to get into that kind of language. I think that what certainly is the case is that there is massive pressure from the business community, from people who just want a short-term fix to do something somewhere. My point is that this is the wrong place. Yes, we can do brilliant things with aviation capacity expansion, but the tragedy with Heathrow now, just looking at a noise map of London. Where do you live, Ian?
I live in Tunbridge Wells.
In Tunbridge Wells.
I get a bit of Gatwick noise, but I'm quite happy to accept it.
You're just about all right. You won't get much, and you won't feel a thing in Tunbridge Wells. But I'm looking at a map here of the noise profile over London, and it is truly appalling. The extra flights over the city and the extra noise that would be generated.
If David Cameron in the end does decide to accept the recommendations, would you follow Zach Goldsmith and resign in your seat in Uxbridge?
No, I certainly won't be resigning in Uxbridge and South Ryswick, nor will I be resigning as Mayor of London. I'm going to keep going, making the case. We've got a long way to go on this, Ian. I'm afraid I've got to go now because we're all mustering now in front of a giant map of the destructive effects.
I'm sure we will hear from Theo Usherwood about that event in just a few moments' time. Boris Johnson, thank you very much indeed. Right, let's go to your calls. Jay's in Harlow. Hello, Jay.
Hi, morning, Ian. How are you?
I'm very well. What would you like to say?
I'm all for airport expansion, whichever airport it is. Obviously, I live in Harlow, so Stansted is only 8 miles up the road to us. We do fly at Heathrow quite a lot because we prefer it to Gatwick. It's more like passenger friendly. Stansted obviously doesn't have the variation of destinations that obviously Heathrow does. But the point that I'd like to make, and I don't think any commission or any study has ever been done, is all the people that live round Heathrow or, for example, up by Stansted, how many of them have actually moved to that area to live? Because I don't see if you move to an area where you know there is an airport and you know there is noise, I don't see how you can make any complaint about you don't like the noise level if you've chose to uproot your family and move to that area.
I do agree with you to a large extent. I suppose it depends on the extent of the noise. If you move to an area and an airport is a sort of quiet little airport and then suddenly it becomes a major international airport, you may have cause to complain. But I do take your point on that.
Heathrow's been a major airport for the last 30, 40 years. If not longer, and I mean, Stansted's certainly been an upcoming airport with the same noise level.
Well, I grew up 6 miles from Stansted near Saffron Walden, and of course there was virtually no airport when I was a kid, and now it's a major airport, and my parents live under the flight path, and actually, nobody's ever really complained about that noise, but I think it's very different in Stansted to compare it to Heathrow or even Gatwick. I think you look at the frequency of the flights coming into Heathrow, and it's literally at some point, sometimes every 30 seconds. And if you live directly under that, of course you're going to have a view on the noise. Of course you're going to have a view on the air pollution.
Yeah, that's it. And I think the Davies Commission has overlooked the possibility, as Boris Johnson said in his thing that he'd done with Nick Ferrari at the O2 Indigo, that why is Stansted not being considered as a viable option to increase traffic into the southeast? They've got good commuter links down to London with the trains and the coaches. The underground could be extended from Epping up to Stansted quite easily.
Yep.
So, you know, why was Stansted not considered?
Well, it was considered and they rejected it. And I think it was on the basis that none of the airlines want to go there. I don't understand it. I think Stansted is a fabulous airport, but they all want to go to Heathrow. I mean, I can't explain that one, but that's just what they want to do. Thank you, Jay. Let's go to Steve, who's in Marylebone. Hello, Steve.
Hi. I almost felt that Nick was like Chemical Alley. He's totally in denial when you were questioning him about Gatwick.
Which Nick?
The Nick who's the chief executive.
Oh, right. OK, yep.
Yeah, you know, it's like, oh, no, it's not over yet. Hang on. You've just had the report endorsing Heathrow, and here you are, you're still...
Well, the fat lady hasn't sung yet, but she's revving up her voice, I suppose.
Let's be be quite frank, when you go to Gatwick and you see airport information desks unattended or they're closed, and you then go somewhere and it says, if there's a problem, call this number or go to the airport information desk, which is then closed, or the major car parks to actually get in are closed off, even though there's ample space, causing tailbacks, you're not dealing with an international airport. You're dealing with a provincial airport who can't handle it. They don't know what they're doing. I'm sorry.
Well, I think that's being slightly unfair. I mean, most of the time...
You're a user of the airport. You see what airports are like. Heathrow is a slick operation. Gatwick just doesn't feel like it's the real deal. I'm sorry. It's just how it is.
Well, you may say that. Whenever I've been to Gatwick, it's been incredibly busy. I suppose it depends. Maybe if you go late at night, it would be different. But, yeah, it's not the same as Heathrow. It doesn't pretend to be the same as Heathrow. I actually don't, and this is going to be controversial, I don't understand why you can't actually expand both of them. I think that within 30 years, there will be the capacity for both to be full. So why not do that? I mean, OK, yes, of course, if you did both, there would be much more sort of many more environmental consequences from that. But either we want to stay as a major league economic power and sort of airport capacity is part of that, or we don't. Ahmed is in New Malden. Hello, Ahmed.
Good morning, Ian.
Good morning. Yes.
The Airports Commission's recommendation to build a third Heathrow runway the only right recommendation. You know, the thing is, do we want to, in fact, they should have gone further, recommend, as you have already mentioned, they should have recommended a fourth runway for Heathrow, plus another runway for Gatwick.
Well, let's have a fifth, let's have a sixth. Why not go the whole hog?
No.
I'm joking.
Runway at Stansted and Heathrow, at Gatwick. Because, I mean, the thing is, do we want to compete with the rest of the world? China is building more than 100 airports within less than 10 years. We are dithering on every important issue. Do we want to compete with the rest of the world or not?
Well, I think we do, and I think we have to do everything that it takes. If you look at the number of flights that go to various Chinese city from Frankfurt, I think I'm right in saying there are 81 every day. From our airports, there are fewer than 20. I mean, that statistic sums it all up for me.
Well, you know, the Far East, the thing is, in the Far East, there's a lot more air traffic going on now in the emerging countries.
And if we can't provide that capacity, they will go to Frankfurt, to Schiphol, to Charles de Gaulle.
Yeah, if we don't get our act together and build a third and fourth runway at Heathrow, I think business will go elsewhere. This is a question. We dither on every important issue that could benefit the country.
It's really interesting, Ahmed. Since I said that I thought there should be expansion at both, loads of people have been tweeting. Finally, someone's saying it. So maybe that's something the government might want to consider. I don't know whether Gatwick or Heathrow. I'm sure Heathrow wouldn't want expansion at Gatwick under any circumstances. But in the end, that's for the Prime Minister and the Transport Secretary to decide. Patrick McLaughlin, the Transport Secretary, will be making a statement to the House of Commons later. He's not going to make a decision. That will have to wait till later in the year. So yet again, the decision is kicked down the road. I'm Ian Dale, looking back at my week on Breakfast. More coming up in a moment. This is LBC. This is Ian Dale with my look back at the week whilst I've been standing in for Nick Ferrari at breakfast here on LBC. And this is quite an incredible story in some ways. Audiences have booed and jeered the Royal Opera House's new production of William Tell over the addition of a rape scene. The Rossini Opera was savaged during its opening night by both the public and critics. And it takes something for the sort of upper middle classes who... I'm assuming it's upper middle classes who go to the Royal Opera House. Maybe that's a wrong assumption on my part. But for them to boo during an opera rather than at the end, I think says a lot. Well, is it ever acceptable to include a scene like this in a stage production? Well, let's talk to Jill Saywood, independent rape campaigner and a victim of rape herself. Jill, it's very good to talk to you again. What's your reaction to this? Because, I mean, it's not as if rape hasn't been depicted quite often on television, for example.
Yeah, I think there's a difference, though, between television and theatre. Theatre, you feel like you're there and you're part of it. And I think that people would feel that they were voyeuristic if they couldn't sort of express themselves and express disdain and dislike of what they're seeing.
But people presumably realise it. Well, it's an opera. It's fiction. It's meant to be dramatic, and presumably they also go. They know what the plot of the opera is. And I know this was a sort of modern day production, bringing it up to date. But I'm not sure why people would have been so surprised.
I don't know that everybody does know the stories when they go to see opera. Evidently, I haven't seen this opera, and I don't know the story of William Tell either as an opera. But I think that people can feel quite often that you don't actually have to show everything for the message to get across.
Mm.
And I think some people just want to try and be cutting edge and sort of push the boundaries and get publicity by doing something that actually the audience find distasteful.
So the intention, you think, was to shock. And I suppose, I mean, the fact that we're talking about it now, it was on Newsnight last night, all sorts of other things, I suppose it will sell tickets, won't it?
I think it will sell tickets to a certain amount of people. It may stop other people from going, which is sad, because obviously then it's showing to the wrong sort of people. I think that, you know, you have to be very careful when you're portraying rape, and particularly a gang rape scene. You know, it doesn't have to be as explicit as some people would make it in terms of what they actually show and what they depict.
I
think you just have to be very careful in the way that you put it across.
I suppose their defence would be that they've brought it up to date. It's meant it's relocated to the Balkan crisis of the 1990s, and we all know that very sadly there were a lot of gang rapes that took place during that period. So they would argue, I suppose, that they're just depicting something that really did happen.
Yes, but I think then that you have to be very clear in what you're putting out in your publicity, that this is actually what you're doing, rather than depicting what some people would have understood to be an opera from the, you know, a historical opera type of thing. And whether it's fantasy or not, I think that there is a sense where people feel that you're putting them into a situation and they have no other form of response than to boo.
OK, Jill, thank you very much indeed. That's Jill Soward, independent rape campaigner. I think she's got a very valid point there. In fact, I don't go to the opera, I can't stand it. But if I did, I would not want to see a scene like that, would you? I don't think anyone would. Well, one person who did go has phoned in. Mary is in Croydon. Hello, Mary. Now, you were at the opera, and what did you make of it?
I was there, Ian. I thought it was pretty disgraceful. And one of the things I want to say is this isn't the first really bad, really, really bad production that they've put on at the Opera House in the past 2 years or so, perhaps a bit longer. We've seen one horror after another, but this one, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. Now, what happened was, it was a dreadful production. It was getting worse and worse. The singing, on the other hand, was glorious. But you got to that rape scene, and I think everybody just erupted in anger. I was one of the people that booed. Everybody around me, not a single person near me, was not booing. And also, what is not being mentioned is the number of people that walked out.
Mm.
I could see from my seat in the stalls. Sorry, I could see into the stalls. I was in the upper
seat. You were in the cheap seats, were you, Mary?
I paid £13, and I'll proudly say I am a working-class opera-goer who's been going for over 40 years.
You see, as soon as I said earlier, the upper-middle classes, I thought, I bet I get somebody who says, I'm not upper-middle class, I go to the opera.
Somebody once told me, no, I'm not working-class, I am middle-class, because I do go to the opera.
I would agree with them.
Down that line. We won't go down that line.
And how often do you go?
Well, it depends what's showing what I want to see, but I usually go once every 1 to 5 weeks, I would say.
And when you went to see this, I don't know if there's any pre-publicity about this scene, but were you aware that this was going to be depicted?
I wasn't aware. Perhaps I should have looked on the website. I was excited because William Tell is an opera I've never seen before. By the way, it's hugely long. It starts at 6 o'clock and it finishes at 10:30.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, how could anyone stand it?
Oh, us opera fans love it. Oh. But listen, Ian, nobody will go to this for a cheap thrill because, you know, all those hours of Rossini, if you've never been to an opera before, just to see a few minutes of a naked woman. That kind of audience simply won't go.
No.
But the seats
wouldn't appeal to me.
And this particular production team are doing another opera very shortly, and I know that people are already sending their tickets back. They're not even going to go. So that's how bad things have got at the opera.
I'm not surprised. You know, there's a lot of interest in opera. A few weeks ago, I did a phone-in on opera on my Drive Time show, and I said to my producer, who on earth is going to phone in about opera? Do you know the switchboard was full almost from the first minute? So there's a lot of interest in it out there. Mary, thank you for that. We talked about radicalisation in schools a few moments ago. Let's talk to Sadiq in Ilford. What would you like to say, Sadiq?
Hi, good morning, Ian. It's a beautiful day.
It is.
Ian, just a couple of things. Look, the hypocrisy of the politicians and whatever. As a Muslim, and in no way am I justifying radicalisation.
But I can sense a but coming on.
I'm going to tell you why Muslim children are being radicalised, if we're honest enough to listen to the answer from a Muslim who understands the situation. On a daily basis, these children are seeing brutal pictures of Muslims being butchered around the world, and the politicians stay silent on it. And then what happens is when on the other side it's condemned. I'm not justifying it.
But they're being butchered by fellow Muslims. That's the problem.
On some occasions, and on most occasions, you're absolutely right, Ian. But on many other occasions, not the case. But let me give you another a look at it, Ian. Our education minister has said homophobia could be one of the reasons of signs of radicalisation. I think she will need to be investigated because she herself has voted 3 times against same-sex marriage.
Voting against same-sex marriage does not imply necessarily that you're homophobic.
So, therefore, having the view that homosexuality is a sin in a faith does not render you to be an extremist by the same token.
No, it doesn't necessarily mean that you are, but I suppose it could, couldn't it?
Right. But, Ian, my point being is that if a child of any other faith in the playground, and we all grew up with this, let's be honest about it, would shout out in the playground about a sexual orientation just to hurt a child or call it names, no other child will be picked up. But if a Muslim child does it, they will be investigated immediately.
I would hope that you're wrong on that. I think if any child does it, I mean, I know for a fact that a friend of mine's got a child at primary school and made a perfectly innocent comment about somebody's background. I'm not going to go into the detail. And it was a perfectly innocent comment. And the parents were hauled in and basically said, well, you've got to stop this. And he said, yeah, but that's a word that this child uses about himself. So you can go over the top in this and become a little bit too politically correct, I think. Sadiq, Mark is in Highgate and wants to talk about the opera that we were discussing a few moments ago. Mark, what would you like to say?
Well, I was there at the performance. What happened was that the guys who were presenting this had a lot of cliched ideas. They lacked originality. People were getting more and more irritated with this production and irritated with the stagecraft. I mean, it's rotten lighting, poor movement of the chorus and that sort of thing. And so, you know, you talk to people in the intervals and people are getting absolutely exasperated. By the time this rape scene came on, it just burst out and people started booing.
Have you ever seen that before?
That broke the camel's back.
Have you ever seen that before?
I've seen rape scenes.
No. Yes. I meant booing in the middle of an opera.
In the middle of an opera, no. No, that's very unusual. I've seen booing at the end in various places, including London. But in the middle, no. But the pent-up frustration with this production just burst out.
What is it about opera that causes people to react like that? Because I've never been to the theatre and seen, even if you've gone to see a production, a musical or a play that was absolute rubbish, I've never heard of a theatre audience getting up and booing either during it or after it.
Well, I think it's an emotional thing.
You're just a rude really lot, aren't you, opera goers?
Yeah, it really gets. I mean, it's a combination of music, wonderful music, and the words and the whole scenario.
Because people do get wrapped up in opera. It's a very sort of emotional experience, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So I'm told.
They get horribly wrapped up in it. And you can do things with opera that you really can't do with other art forms, because you've got the music expressing the emotions or what's going on, and then you can do something different.
And then
the
screeching
stage.
Of the singing. You see, I think it's lovely music in operas, but I regard operatic singing as screeching, which I know I'm a terrible person for thinking that, but...
Well, some singers do screech, and I think most people don't like that.
This is Ian Dale. I've been in for Nick Ferrari at breakfast all this week, and we're taking a look back at some of the highlights. More to come after the news. This is LBC. This is Ian Dale with my look back at the week whilst I've been standing in for Nick Ferrari at breakfast here on LBC. Children's television shows like Peppa Pig should feature more homosexual characters, one of the two contenders to lead the Liberal Democrats has said. Norman Lamb said it was not out of bounds that characters on the popular Channel 5 programme should be homosexual. He said that more children's TV programmes should depict loving same-sex relationships so that children growing up would know that it was acceptable to be gay. In an interview with Pink News, Mr. Lamb said he wanted more TV companies to address why there were not more visible lesbian, gay, bisexual or transgender characters on their children's programmes. He said legislation very clearly says that a loving relationship between two people of the same sex is of equal value, so in everything that we then do as a society, we need to reinforce that, not deny it. Asked if there should be gay characters in Peppa Pig, he said if you impose arbitrary limits, you're saying that actually at heart it's not equitable. It should absolutely not be out of bounds, which it appears to be at the moment. It's inconsistent with the philosophy that's led to the legislation. That's the principal point, so we have to be clear and consistent. Well, let's hear from Alan Craig, Christian campaigner and grassroots activist. Alan, very good morning.
Good morning, Shireen.
Now, I'm going to be daring here and hazard a guess that you don't agree with Norman Lamb. Doesn't he have a point, though, in that if you have legislation that gives same-sex couples equal value in society, that should be reflected in our media, including children's programmes?
I think my perspective on this is that Norman Lamb is running for leader of the Lib Dems, isn't he? And I think my concern is that the politicians increasingly using our children to promote their particular political interests or their own particular political ideologies. That would be much more concern to me, if I'm honest. I really am concerned that the politicians are now playing with our children. I see the other day Nicky Morgan, of all people, the education secretary, came out and said children who say homosexuality is wrong could be viewed as an extremist threat. And, of course, we're worried about ISIS and things like this. I mean, where does this stop? The politicians shouldn't be playing with our children. Children should be allowed to get on with their education. And I'm afraid that Norman Lamb is just playing into that. I'm sure it plays well in the Lib Dem gallery. But leave our kids alone.
Well, what do you mean by leave our kids alone? I mean, he's not trying to say that sort of kids should be forced to be gay. He's just trying to say, well, look, we have a lot of gay people in society. They now have equal validity with straight people in our legislation. Let's reflect that on the media.
I don't think he's saying that at all, Ian. He's playing a political game. Let me just give you a different example. I have in front of me a book that's authorised by Birmingham Education Authority. Okay, this is aimed for primary school children, so we're talking about prepubescent children. I have in front of me a cartoon, so we're talking about cartoons, aren't we? So it's a cartoon for children, and it shows men dressed up in leathers and chains, dressed all in black with military hats, military caps, bare-chested and straps and so on.
Which, of course, is how all gay men are like that, aren't they?
No, they're not like that. I don't think that's what this particular book is saying. What they're saying is they want the children to participate. They call it this day in June, promoting participation in pride marches. So there's an agenda behind, a political agenda behind these cartoons. So with Nicky Morgan and with Norman Lamb and with this Birmingham Education Authority authorised book, they're promoting a political agenda. This particular one, this hint of sadomasochism, with these men all dressed in black, and only men, by the way, in this cartoon, no women at all, not very diverse in that sense. There is a political agenda behind it, and I have to say, well, my position would be let me just finish my point here. My position would be absolutely with UKIP and Paul Nuttall said the other, the deputy leader said the other day, there should be no sex and relationships education at all in primary schools. We're talking about
we don't live in the 1950s any longer, Alan. We live in 2015, and in the 2015, children unfortunately, and on this maybe we have some common ground, unfortunately, children are exposed to sexualisation at a much earlier age than they were when you and I were growing up. Now, therefore, you either put your head in the sand and you try and ignore it, and then that leads to enormous risks for them when they do reach puberty, or you try and teach them about relationships. I don't want children at the age of five to be taught about sex, but I'm quite happy for them to know of the different kind of relationships that can happen.
You're beginning to speak the sort of language there. I'm talking about the politicisation, imposing of political agendas on our children. I believe that you're right.
It's not a political agenda, Alan.
It's a very different society today from which you and I were brought up. I absolutely agree. And there are very good aspects to that society. It's much better and much than it was when we were being brought up. So I don't doubt that. My objection is the politicians using our children as political football, people imposing their political agendas in this particular...
But what is the political agenda here?
Well, imposing that on our children.
What is the political agenda?
It's a political... Of course it's a
political agenda. What is it? What is the political agenda? You keep using this phrase without explaining what it is.
But Norman Lamb is playing to the Lib Dem gallery in order to get himself elected. So he plays for our children. He thinks something that might be popular in that particular one, he plays for our children.
That's
my point. And on all these examples I've given to you, Ian, they're fairly important examples. We're talking about the Education Secretary. We're talking about the Birmingham Education Authority. They are promoting an agenda. And I think our children...
So basically, reading between the lines, you'd like to go back to the days of Section 28 when teachers weren't even allowed to mention the word homosexuality.
I have seen some extremely good education for children. I've got daughters myself that have been through primary school and now in secondary school. I've seen some extremely good, careful... respectful. Well, there's no agenda. It's almost scientific, if I can put it like that. It's neutral. But that's not what the politicians run about. And they're playing with our children.
You keep using that rather unfortunate phrase. But would you include would you include disabled people in children's programmes, black people in the children's programmes? If you would include those, why wouldn't you include gay people?
I don't actually have any particular particular difficulty with gay people being shown or disabled people, I mean, or any of them at all. But what concerns me much more is that our politicians and the authorities imposing their political agendas.
Well, you keep saying this.
And that is what Norman Lamb is doing absolutely deliberately, and I think it's time somebody said don't.
Well, you just have. Alan, thank you. That's Alan Craig, Christian campaigner, making his views very clear that homosexual characters should not be included in children's programmes. Maybe you'd like to give me a call about that. But John in Cheshunt. Hello, John.
Yes, hi. Yes, I've got a 25-year-old and a 5-year-old, so I've been watching children's TV for a very long time.
Oh, dear,
now.
You poor man.
And what I've noticed is they are, what sort of portraying sexual relationships, which I think is wrong. You know, children don't need that. You know, they're watching stuff, long as it's love, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's two men, two women, man and woman, it's not important at that age. But what they shouldn't do is actually stick it down their throat. Even I watch Peppa Pig now, and the things they're coming out with, sexual things, it's totally irrelevant.
Well,
totally
give me an example, because it may come as a huge shock to you that I've never seen Peppa Pig.
Well, good for you. You're lucky.
hardly ever seen Channel 5 come to that matter. But
adult innuendos and, Daddy, you're fat, and they're laughing at Daddy. I know it's not a sexual thing, but it's still this thing between adult stuff.
John, I think that this has happened in children's programmes right down the years, where there's always been a bit of innuendo and it's become a sort of in-adult joke. I don't think I can even mention them, but I mean, if you look at the Teletubbies, which I remember somebody showing me an episode of that, and it was just full. If you wanted to go looking for it, it was full of double entendres. Now, the kids would never get them, you would hope, but I think for the parents watching, they would have probably found them quite amusing. I mean, I don't want a 5 or 6 year old being taught about sex. I don't want a 5 or 6 year old being able to watch sex or any mild form of sex on a TV programme. But I do believe that it's important to teach 5 and 6 year olds about relationships. Antonia is in Purley. Hello, Purley. Hello, Antonia.
Hello.
It's all going so well. What would you like to say?
Well, I'd like to say, first of all, that I'm a parent, and I know lots of other families as well, obviously. And I think the problem with putting homosexual characters in children's programmes is that it's intruding an issue into families when they may not be expecting that, and it's sort of forcing parents to have to address these issues with their young children at a time when they may not want to do that. And I think it's I'm very, very concerned about families, that this is, as I say, issues coming into the family home and taking parents by surprise and introducing these issues.
Is it any different, though, from, say, your son or daughter coming home and saying, "Mummy, why has my friend Jimmy got two mummies or two daddies?"
It's different from the point of view that, I mean, Peppa Pig is aimed at much younger children, although that could happen to a child of any age. But it's just, you know, television, parents would like to feel that they can switch on the television for their children and they can, you know, they're not going to have these issues coming at them. Now, for a child at school, it would probably be the parents would probably be very well aware, if there's a child in the class, if the child's at school, where the child's got two parents, and then, you know, the parents will, a child's parents can address that and deal with it. I feel that this is just an intrusion into family life, and I think that it's yet another example of parents being undermined, that this area of their children's upbringing explained to them about human relationships, about human sexuality, is being increasingly taken out of the hands of parents, and being forced, their children are being forced into addressing these issues either by the school or now by television, and it's leaving parents feeling absolutely helpless.
Okay, Antonia, thank you very much. Of course, you think back to the days of Zippy and Bungle and some of the characters in the Magic Roundabout. You know, I reckon half of them were subliminally gay, but people just didn't realise it at the time. We are also talking about school lunchboxes. Should teachers have the right to take things out of children's school lunchboxes? Nick in Seaford is going to tell us what he thinks. Hello, Nick.
Good morning. How are you?
Hi, not too bad. What would you like to say?
I'm just like to say, I mean, I've got two small children that go to one of the first schools in Seaford, and they've had a what's called a healthy policy adapted for a few years now. And the teachers don't take items out of the lunchbox, but what you do get is a little note just to say, look, we adopted a healthy lifestyle policy in this school. We're trying to teach the children to make healthier choices. These are some of the things that you could substitute for and send a little note home with you. So they let it go in the school. They don't want to embarrass them in front of their children. But my point is, you know, having teachers take stuff off children in schools, in schools, is kind of like scoring an own goal and then running around the pitch to celebrate. We all know where the problem lies, and that's the cost of healthy living. I'm very healthy, very active. I've lost a lot of weight over the past year or so, about 7.5 stone, and made some different life choices. But I can assure you, my wife and I work, and it's really expensive to buy food. If you look,
did you say you've just lost 7.5 stone?
Yeah, in a year. Yeah.
How on earth did you do that?
By making healthier choices, and instead of driving, walking, I go to the gym 4 times a week, I eat a lot healthier.
I'm Ian Dale, looking back at my week on breakfast. More coming up in a moment. This is LBC. This is Ian Dale with my look back at the week whilst I've been standing in for Nick Ferrari at breakfast here on LBC. A headmistress has banned girls from wearing skirts to stop them from flashing too much flesh and distracting male teachers. I would suggest that if it's distracting male teachers, possibly those male teachers ought to be sacked if they're sort of constantly looking at young girls. I mean, I find this story quite amazing. The head teacher is called Dr. Rowena Blenko. She's had enough of telling girls off for wearing skirts that barely cover their bottoms, adding, as they get older, the skirts get shorter. The problem has gone from a uniform issue to a safeguarding issue because girls were exposing themselves as they walked upstairs and sat down, she said. Dr. Blenko had even resorted to buying girls longer skirts using school funds. Now female pupils at the Trent Momentum High School in Stoke-on-Trent have been told they'll have to swap their skirts for trousers. The end of the world is nigh. Sally James is a uniform retailer at Unismart based in Cobham. Hello, Sally.
Hello, Ian. How are you?
I'm very well. Now, of course, none of this wouldn't be an issue if we just actually abandoned school uniforms altogether like they do in Germany, for example. It doesn't seem to be a problem there.
Well, I think if you don't have school uniform, then people will turn up in all kinds of things.
Oh, and perish the thought.
What that might look like. And then there would still be short skirts in there, wouldn't there? I mean, this is an age-old problem. Girls, apparently, well, I've seen it all the time. We have more arguments in our shop about girls buying skirts. They're arguing with their mothers all the time. I'm not buying it that length. I'm not going to wear it. Then the mother will say, well, you have to have it because that's what the schools say. And then they eventually buy it and they go out. And then all the schools say it must be on the knee. It must be a certain length. And then as soon as they're out of the school premises, you see them rolling them over and they're, you know, like little belts. I don't know how you're ever going to stop girls rolling over skirts. I think it's been going on for years and years and years. I can remember doing it myself, and it was a long, long, long time ago that I was at school, I can tell you.
You hussy. Now, why is it, though, that girls want to do this? Just because they want to sort of be a bit, they want to look cool, or what is the reason?
Do you think it might be because they want to attract some of the lads?
Possibly.
As much leg as they can. I think that could sort of come into play. And, I mean, you know, it is just one of those things. I know schools try so hard. I've got a couple of schools where they've introduced a skirt that's really, really hard to turn over at the waist. It's got sort of lots of pleats, so if you do turn it over, it actually makes them look thick round the middle. But still they do it. And all the heads will say to me, you know, we as they come in, we tell them you've got to have a certain length. And usually in school, I think the girls do comply. It's when they get out of school you see them change it. But it seems in this school, they're not even complying while they're in school. So.
Well, I would say that says more about the head teacher and the teachers than it does about them, to be honest. But maybe I'm being unkind.
Yeah, I mean, discipline in schools is important. We all know that. If you know, and parents should support schools that are trying to enforce discipline, because if you're more disciplined, you're going to learn better and all of those things. And the parents, I think, need to help the teachers with that to enforce the discipline.
Sally, thank you very much. That's Sally James from Unismart in Cobham. Emma is in Ealing. Emma, what would you like to say?
Hi, Ian.
Hello.
Hi. I think it's ludicrous that they're banning short skirts because of the teachers, because I totally agree. If the teachers, you know, are looking at these girls, then clearly they need to be sacked. But I totally agree that in school, girls should wear a skirt to a certain length. I've got a daughter that's just finished her GCSEs. She goes to a girls' school and they have a uniform rule that the skirts have to be to the knee. And if girls arrive to the school below with a skirt below that length, they're sent up. They're not actually sent home. They're made sure that it's sorted out, or they could possibly be sent home. My son also goes to a secondary school, but he goes to a mixed school. My daughter goes to an all-girls school. And at his school, I've witnessed girls with literally skirts just below their buttocks. And, you know, I just don't think that's acceptable. I think
That's up to the parents to do something about it, isn't it? If they only do it out of school, I mean, what can the school do? Surely it's the parents' responsibility.
Well, no, at the school, they seem to allow them with that length of a skirt to the school.
Right.
I think schools should definitely have a rule that girls should wear a skirt to a certain length, because at the end of the day, unfortunately, we live in a world that, you know, you have to adhere to rules. And if you get a job, you cannot just wear what you want. You have to dress respectively. So if we're allowing these girls to go to school with skirts that are just below their bum, I mean, we're setting them up to fail, because they're believing that they can do what they want and dress how they want. And that's not how it goes in life. I do think that, you know, the teacher thing, looking at girls with short skirts, is a serious problem. And that is the problem that the school clearly has.
Mm. Well, I go back to what I said right at the beginning. If we didn't have school uniforms, we wouldn't have this problem. At least I don't think we'd have it so much. They don't have it in Germany. So why would we have it here? Isabel is in Notting Hill. Hello, Isabel.
Oh, hi, Ian.
Hi.
So I just wanted to essentially say that I agree with this head teacher in banning skirts. Simply because, like the other lady just said, you know, at my daughter's school, I had witnessed on numerous occasions girls going into school with their skirts rolled up so high that, you know, they can't even bend down to pick a pencil up. It's really, really bad. And, you know, I brought this to the attention of the head teacher at the school, and she said, oh, no, it doesn't happen in the school. But it does. I've seen it within the school grounds. I mean, it's not only just that. It's so many things. I mean, the girls at 12, 13, plastered in makeup and all sorts of things, I think is absolutely abhorrent.
Well, again, no. It's the parents' fault. Don't blame the school.
Well, no, the thing is, as a parent, yes, you do have a responsibility to ensure that your children are doing as they should do. But at the same time, the schools also have a responsibility to ensure that the rules are being followed. If the schools are not, you know, putting into place rules and penalising students for not following them, then what can the parent do? The parent has no control over what the child does when the child is in school. There's only so much you can do as a parent.
Yeah, but the school isn't going to allow a girl with plastered with makeup into the school, so she's obviously done it at home. Before, really?
Yes, they do.
Well, that...
fair enough. The girl can leave her house with no makeup on, get on the bus, put makeup on. By the time she gets to school, she's got foundation on, eyeliner on, all sorts. I went to an open day where the head teacher gave a speech. We were going around the school. I saw girls with eyeliner and all sorts on within the school on an open day.
All right, I'm now going to be very controversial. Why not? Why shouldn't 13-year-old girls put makeup on if they want to? What's so bad about it?
What's so bad about it? Girls should appreciate what they look like. They shouldn't have to put makeup on to make themselves feel good about themselves.
Do you put makeup on?
No, I don't.
You don't? OK, well, that's ruined my argument then, hasn't it?
I don't wear makeup. I don't
wear makeup. No, but most women do, don't they?
Most women do. I choose not to wear makeup because I don't feel like I should have to wear makeup to feel good about myself. I mean, a 13-year-old girl wearing makeup, imagine what she'll look like when she's 30.
Isabel, stay on the line because you'll want to listen to our next guest. It's Lawrence Morris, who's deputy head of Trentham School in Stoke-on-Trent, the school that we're talking about. Lawrence, very good to talk to you. Thank you for coming on the programme. Good morning.
Morning.
Why is this such a problem in your school? And surely, it ought to be under the control of the head teacher and the teachers to enforce this rule. And clearly, they're not able to do it.
We are able to do it, and I mean, it's not a massive problem in our school compared to any other school. We just felt that we were wasting so much time having conversations about skirt length that it was distracting us from the core business, and just made a decision. Actually, let's stop doing this. And get on with the job.
Why is it such a distraction for male teachers in your school?
Yeah, that's been taken rather out of context. Yeah, it's a distraction from doing the job. It's not that our delicate male staff are getting all of a quiver. It's, you know, when you've got a class coming into the room, you want to get on with the work, you want to get on with the teaching and learning, which, as I said, that's the core business. You don't want to be wasting time having a conversation about skirt length for someone who will then go into the next lesson having rolled her skirt up again and have that same conversation. You know, it's a waste of our time. The point came when we found ourselves in a leadership meeting when we should be talking about continuing to move this school forward, talking about skirt length, and it's, you know, just dawned on us that this is silly.
Mm.
So that's why the decision was made.
Why not just abandon school uniform altogether and just let young people express themselves like they do in other countries? Well, you laugh. Why is that a laughing matter? Because I used to teach in German schools, and let me tell you, German schools are in many ways more effective than British schools, and they don't use any form of school uniform at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you were going to look at the reasons why German schools might be more effective than British schools, I imagine it would come down to funding rather than what they're wearing.
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, yeah, there are also structural issues, funding and all the rest of it. But if they work well enough without school uniforms, I don't see why our schools couldn't either.
Okay. I mean, whether or not to have school uniform is obviously an entirely separate debate. But, yeah, I mean, if you look at Ofsted, certainly expects students to be wearing smart school uniform. And, I mean, if we were to... You know, the point of our school uniform is very clear, it's very simple, very straightforward. So, you know, we don't have things like you can only wear a certain type of earring. We just say you can't wear earrings because then there's no debate, there's no discussion, and we can just focus on what we're supposed to do. If we've got a school uniform that's very clear, very straightforward, then there isn't a debate. We just get on with it. I mean, yeah, the idea about this is how they express their creativity, because somebody else has made this suggestion here, that we're stifling our girls' self-expression. You know, our girls are brilliant. They express their creativity through their science, through their engineering, through their sport, through their poetry.
So why can't they express it through their clothes?
Because if that's all it came down to, it would be a pretty sad view of our young women, wouldn't it?
Well, I'm not sure it would, actually. I think if you actually give people responsibility, they normally accept it with alacrity and react to it. I think that this thought that young people will always sort of go to an extreme, I just think it is wrong. Lawrence, it's been good to talk to you. Thank you. That's Lawrence Morris, deputy head teacher at the Trentham School in Stoke-on-Trent. Norman in Rickmansworth says, surely we can control human action, but not human instinct. That's a little bit deep, isn't it?
I'm Ian Dale, looking back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC.